Okay, we will be reading Beowulf starting tomorrow. So you guys have the task of reading the introduction to Beowulf in your omnibus book. So Beowulf, let's give a little rundown on Beowulf here. Author and context. So Beowulf, on the surface, seems like a very weird and at the same time very interesting story, because it's so far removed from our 21st century minds. Reading it will just seem kind of odd for a while, but it's very, very interesting and quite entertaining. So Beowulf is an Anglo-Saxon poem about a warrior and a monster, and the warrior essentially rips off the monster's arm, puts the bloody arm on display as a tribute to its strength and his valor, and the monster's mother gets mad about it. She's a monster too. She gets mad about the monster's son's death and kills some of the warrior's friends, and then take a few more of them alive to eat later. And the warrior goes to the lake to kill the mother monster, and the parents of the friends that were killed blame the warrior for their kids getting killed, and the warrior made everything good between them by giving them some gold rings. So that's essentially the story. Kind of weird, right? So, I know, I'm not giving it all away. So the author of Beowulf is unknown to us. Don't know who it is. Author is unknown. We don't know who wrote Beowulf. And so it's hard to date the poem. We don't know exactly when it was written either. Many scholars think that Beowulf was written sometime between AD 600 and AD 1000. That's a big gap. So, like I said, what you would call the yachts. This is G-E-A-T-S. You would say Geats, but it's really probably an old Anglo-Saxon English. It's more pronounced like the way we would say the word yacht. So the yachts, which is the people group that the story came from, lived in what is today the southern part of Sweden. And then Beowulf, in the story, visits northern Denmark to see the famous mead hall, Heorot, which is the pride of the Danes. We've read about the Danes in Bede's work, so we know a little bit about them. We've read about the Danes a little bit in The Dragon and the Raven, at least in an historical fiction context. So we know a little bit about all of these tribes. And so the Danes and the Jots are ancestors to who we know as the Vikings, and who would later raid England. And so this leads us to the question, why would an Anglo-Saxon poet write a poem praising the hero of one of the tribes that invaded them?
Why not,
right? Well, to answer that question, we need to know a little bit about the history of early England. So ever since the first century AD, the Roman Empire has included the island of Britain. Anybody show me where the island of Britain is in the world? No, you can get up and point to it, because pointing at the map from there does not tell me anything. Yes, exactly. Very good. Thank you. You may sit down. All right. Yes, that's the island of Britain. So the Roman Empire has occupied the island of Britain ever since the first century AD up until this point. But as more Germanic tribes started invading the city of Rome, someone show me where Rome is. Just one person. You don't even need to move the door. There. So, as more Germanic tribes started invading Rome, many of the Roman soldiers that were in Britain, in order to protect Britain, had to go back to Rome to protect Rome from getting sacked. So this left Britain vulnerable to many foreign invaders. So the British people started hiring mercenaries from some of the Germanic tribes nearby to help protect them. Anybody know what a mercenary is?
Assassin, guard, basic.
Right, basic. Army. Well, in one sense, yes. That's one definition of a mercenary. A mercenary is basically an army for hire. Okay, so they hired these some of these tribes to come in to protect them from other tribes that would want to invade them. Okay? So, and after a while, though, the mercenaries started thinking, well, why not just invade and take over Britain ourselves? So that's what started to happen. So the mercenaries turned on those they were working for, and they invaded and drove the original British people all the way to Wales, all the way to the north of the island. And some of these invader tribes were the Germanic tribes of the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, those who we are familiar with in from Bede's book. And two of these people groups combined and became the Anglo-Saxons. So that's who we know of as the Anglo-Saxons. So, Anglo-Saxons. Later on, Augustine of Canterbury was sent by Pope Gregory to preach the gospel to these tribes, Anglo-Saxons, the Jutes, all these guys. And it was said that Augustine baptized 10,000 of these Anglo-Saxons. So by the year 600, it would be possible for a Christian poet to be writing in the Anglo-Saxon language on the island now known as England. But as we all know, as we've read in Bede's history and many other histories, the conversion to Christianity for a nation was not always smooth sailing. So only one generation ago, up to this point, the Anglo-Saxons had been Germanic Vikings themselves, and they still remembered their pagan roots. And they knew the tales of the great warriors of the previous generations, and even traded goods and services with their pagan neighbors. So this makes for an interesting poem. So it's a poem that's, of course, full of Christian overtones, written by a Christian about a pagan culture and a pagan hero that sometimes seems to worship God and other times seems to be rank pagans. So the story in and of itself seems very inconsistent, but these are the reasons why. Beowulf is the longest Anglo-Saxon poem known to the modern world. It has 3,182 lines.
Right? That's a line.
That is a lot. What's a line? Yeah. It's literally a sentence, a line. Yeah, it's big. So Beowulf has long been recognized as one of the greatest stories of Western civilization. It was one of J.R.R. Tolkien's favorite poems, and many of Tolkien's stories were inspired by Beowulf. Orcs, Ents, runic letters, the Riders of Rohan, the Sleeping Dragon, getting mad about a cup getting stolen, all of that was in Beowulf well before it was in Tolkien. So Tolkien stole some of that stuff, in a sense, from Beowulf.
Pope Gregory, what did he do? Was he in here too?
Pope Gregory was in Rome. Remember, he sent Augustine of Canterbury to go and preach the gospel to the island, to the people of Britain.
So they don't know who wrote Beowulf, but they just rewrote it.
Essentially, it's been passed down through tradition.
And that's why it says, has made a masterpiece out of a masterpiece.
What?
It says,
I didn't read the front.
Seamus
Henley is the translator. He translated the Old English into what we see there.
Okay.
So, yeah, so they're talking about the translator. Okay? And it's not Seamus, it's Seamus. Very Scotch-Irish.
Where did they find this?
Huh?
Where did they find it?
I don't know. It's just been in tradition ever since that time.
It says the oldest manuscript has from 1000. That's why it was 600.
That's why it was, yeah, that's why it was gauged to be from 600 to 1000. Yeah, they found a manuscript. Similar to how they find biblical manuscripts. They found this one, the earliest one, to be about 1000. So, couldn't have been written any later than that, obviously. So, all right. Christianity in Beowulf. I'm not going to go over the characters. I'm not going to go over the plot because I really don't want to give it away. I won't let you guys read it and enjoy it. But I will talk about some of the worldview behind it. So, Christianity in Beowulf. One of the most interesting questions that comes to mind when discussing the worldview of Beowulf is the question of its Christianity. It seems very obvious as you read that the poet was a Christian and he was writing for a Christian audience. The poet refers a lot to God and he refers to many biblical stories that we all know, like creation, Cain and Abel, and the flood. But what about the faith of the characters in the poem? He doesn't seem to be as consistent when it comes to them. So at one point, a song is sung to give the God of the Bible praise. And at another time, paganism seems to be celebrated, all in the same book. So there seems to be somewhat of a tension between Christianity and paganism here. And sorting out this tension between the two in Beowulf isn't easy. Many people, many scholars throughout the ages have tried to do it. But we have to see that throughout the poem, success and victory, any victories that are had in battle, the poet always attributes to the mercy and the grace of God. So that's one point in the Christian camp, right? So it seems that the poet wanted to be honest about the paganism of his ancestors. So he included the fact that they were prone to pagan practices. And at the same time, he saw a virtue in their strength and in their courage, which he greatly admired. So as a Christian, the poet credited the strength of the characters in the poem to the only thing that made sense to him, which was the grace and the mercy of God. And maybe another reason that the poet highlights paganism is that he wanted to show these pagan ancestors to be noble, and at the same time show us that nobility, apart from Christ, is still not good enough to save them. The triune nature, the Trinity, the nature of God and the Godhead, is never clearly expressed in the poem. And the cross of Christ is never mentioned. And because of this, some scholars have said that the Beowulf poet pictured his characters as Old Testament saints. That is, men who knew and worshiped the one true Creator God, but who had not yet received the fullness of revelation that came through the Son and the New Testament. And so the reader, as you read, you will be able to easily compare some of the characters of Beowulf to King David or to Gideon or Samson. They'll have a lot of similar qualities and a lot of similar circumstances. Word of warning. I read Beowulf when I was probably about your age, and I read it in the public school. And there was no mention of Beowulf being Christian at all. So I really got the raw end of that deal because I didn't get the whole story. Another thing that I want to warn you not to do that I did when I read this book, this poem, was do not picture the entire story in a dreary shade of gray. I know you haven't read it yet, so you don't know. But as you read, it will seem like this, you know... What do you think of when you think of the Middle Ages? Not the good stuff, not the knights and armor. What else? What are some bad things that you think of? Peasants, disease, vermin. Yeah. People being muddy. I think of Monty Python whenever everybody's like wallowing in their own filth. That's a caricature of the Middle Ages. And that's a very wrong and improper caricature of the Middle Ages. So I think of dungeons, which is gray. I think of just, that's the thing. Like, don't, when you start reading it, remember this warning. Do not picture the entire story in various shades of dreary gray, as many people have done in our day. Okay? So the idea that the early people of the Middle Ages spent their time living in burlap sacks, covered in mud, and always smelling like something you might have stepped in, is woefully inaccurate, okay? So we must see that our Anglo-Saxon ancestors in the faith considered beauty one of the greatest gifts that God has ever given to man, okay? The Enlightenment and the 20th century and 19th century has given the Middle Ages a bad rap, and they have thrusted these improper images of Middle Ages upon us. And it's just simply not true. Now, was there lack of sanitation sometimes in some places? Yep, in London and in the major cities? Definitely. Yeah, definitely. It was, some aspects of it was pretty gross. Yes. Well, imagine there's no indoor plumbing, and you live in a city.
So
what did the people do to their waste? That's if they lived in an elevated building,
they wasted it.
They threw it out the window. Like, all that junk landed in the street. And what gathers in the street to eat the waste? Rats. What do rats carry? Disease. Black death. Anyway, okay. So anyway, don't think of the Middle Ages as this dreary, ugly, stinky time. Okay, so the Anglo-Saxons understood beauty, and they understood that beauty starts with God's work at creation. The word used the most in Beowulf to describe God's creativity and his creative action is the verb shope. Shope, it's Old English. It's actually spelled S-C-O-P, but it's pronounced shope. Which rhymes with soap, coincidentally. Yes. So, and the word shope literally means to shape. It's where we get our word shape from.
And you can shape.
So God is the great shaper. And that's what they thought. And all the natural beauty that the Anglo-Saxons' eyes saw all around them was the fruit of God's imagination, the great shaper. Right? So, since God was an artist, since he was an artist, the Anglo-Saxons understood that, as Christians, it was their job to be artists as well. Therefore, a helmet wasn't just great because of its strength. It was also great because of its beauty. It was beautiful. Very often, the helmets were ornamented to look like boar's heads. And the front of ships were also ornamented to look that way. Swords were crafted not only with strength, but with beauty in mind. You know, one common way to add beauty to a sword was the process of pattern welding. Pattern welding. Anybody heard of that? Maybe some of you have read Beowulf before, or have gone through this lesson before and have heard of these things. So basically, in pattern welding, the person making the sword would take several bars of differently shaded iron. He would twist the bars together and then hammer the twisted bars out into a sword. So the result would be a sword with different colored patterns worked into the blade. Yeah.
They were different colors?
Yeah, just woven into what looks like one blade. So as you work, as we work through Beowulf, as you read Beowulf, carefully read the various descriptions of armor, of the weapons, the ships, and treasure, and ask yourself whether gray, dark, and dreary really describes the Anglo-Saxon world. There was another meaning to the word shope besides shape. Shope was also the word for a poet. So the Anglo-Saxons understood that in using beautiful words and imagery to craft a poem, the poet imitated God's own creative work in making the world. So an example of this is the poetic device of the kinning. Who remembers the kinning? This is way back when. So yeah, the kinning. The kinning basically is a putting together a compound of two words that creates a third word with a new meaning. So, for example, anybody know what a kinning is? Anybody have heard of this poetic device?
Last time, the translation we were using to all
that. Yeah, right. So, for instance, rather than saying something boring like Beowulf crossed the sea, an Anglo-Saxon might say what? Beowulf crossed the railroad.
In the other translation, they actually put like whale road.
They actually put the kinnings in. The whale road, the road of the whales. So doesn't that add a different dimension to the poem when you put things that way? The whale
like,
road?
This like translation doesn't have that.
Not railroad, whale road.
Like
road.
Or this translation doesn't do that.
It doesn't do that? Yeah, bummer. Yeah.
Or lifeblood?
Lifeblood. What's lifeblood?
Blood.
Just blood? Yeah, lifeblood. It adds that extra dimension in it. The dragon is a sky plague. That's how they describe a dragon. Or a throne is a treasure seat. The king sits on it. Or the body is a bone house.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
A bone house, a house of bones. So these are just a few examples of how the poet sought to beautify his poem and glorify God by imitating God's creativity. I know. It's a shame. We may just have to make up our own Kennings for him.
The last time I read that, read this, we made our own poems like it.
Yeah, we'll probably do that again.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. It'll be 3,000 lines, too.
No, I'm joking.
Uh-huh. Right, exactly. Get to work. So there are a lot of elements in Beowulf that point to and glorify God as our creator. Okay? So I want you guys to keep that in mind as you read this poem.